election quality violates norms of substantive objectivity in the same manner as the use of any straight government handout by the Times or Pravda. The Nicaraguan election was remarkable for the number of foreign observers and observer teams. We pointed out earlier that Time mentioned 450 foreign observers, but the magazine failed to cite any one of them, relying instead and characteristically on State Department handouts. As we heard, the State Department was able to get the media to follow its agenda, even though this involved them in a blatant reversal of the criteria they had employed the same year in El Salvador and Guatemala. It was also able to induce the media to disregard the outcome of the Nicaraguan election with the help of the diversionary MIG ploy. The media also allowed major lies to be institutionalized, for example, that coercion was greater and pluralistic choices less in the Nicaraguan than in the Salvadoran and Guatemalan elections, and that the latter were legitimizing in a substantive sense in contrast with Nicaragua. These propaganda lies could not have been perpetrated if such reports as those of the Irish delegation and Lassa had been accorded proper weight. Lassa actually contacted the major mass media outlets and tried to interest them in doing a story on their report. Lassa was turned down by every major outlet. The Lassa report is probably the best documented and most closely reasoned observer report ever written. Its authors are far and away the most qualified group ever to write such a report, half with field experience in Nicaragua. And the document was an official report of the major scholarly organization that deals with Central America. The authors represent a variety of opinions, on balance liberal, but revealing a strong critical capability, and in no sense biased, as are the official observer teams to whom the media accord much attention. Their report covers every issue of importance and openly confronts and weighs evidence. If one reads the Lassa report and then the accounts of the Nicaraguan election in Time, Newsweek, and the New York Times, it is not so much the difference in conclusions that is striking, but the difference in depth, balance, and objectivity. Lassa offers serious history and context, a full account of the organization of the election, and a full discussion of each relevant issue with comparisons to other elections. We believe that an important reason the mass media failed to use Lassa as a source of information was that its report contradicts in every way the propaganda claims which the media were disseminating daily and uncritically. Thus, its very credibility, objectivity, and quality were disturbing and necessitated that it be bypassed by institutions serving a propaganda function. 3.10. Concluding note. As we have seen, electoral conditions in Nicaragua in 1984 were far more favorable than in El Salvador and Guatemala, and the observer team of Lassa found the election in Nicaragua to have been a model of probity and fairness by Latin American standards. In El Salvador and Guatemala, none of the five basic preconditions of a free election was met. In both of these countries, state-sponsored terror, including the public exposure of mutilated bodies, had ravaged the civilian population up to the very day of the elections. In both, voting was required by law, and the populace was obliged to have ID cards signed, testifying that they had voted. In both, the main rebel opposition was off the ballot by law, by credible threat of violence, and by plan. Nevertheless, in exact accord with the propaganda line of the state, the U.S. mass media found the large turnouts in these countries to be triumphs of democratic choice, the elections legitimizing and fledgling democracies thus created. This was accomplished in large part by the media's simply refusing to examine the basic conditions of a genuinely free election and their application to these client state elections. Only for the Nicaraguan election did the media look at matters such as freedom of the press, and they did this with conspicuous dishonesty. Despite its superiority and every substantive count, the Nicaraguan election was found by the media to have been a sham and to have failed to legitimize. Given the earlier similar performance of the mass media in the cases of the U.S.-sponsored elections in the Dominican Republic in 1966 and Vietnam in 1967, we offer the tentative generalization that the U.S. mass media will always find a third-world election sponsored by their own government a step toward democracy, and an election held in a country that their government is busily destabilizing a farce and a sham. This is, of course, what a propaganda model would predict. Although the degree of subservience to state interests in the cases we have examined was extraordinary, given the absence of overt coercion, the filters yield a propaganda result that a totalitarian state would be hard put to surpass. Having perpetrated a successful fraud in the interests of the state, the media proceeded, in subsequent years, to reinforce the imagery established by their deception. Guatemala and El Salvador were new democracies with elected presidents. Nicaragua, in contrast, is a Marxist-Leninist dictatorship that does not have an elected president and would never permit elections unless compelled to do so by U.S. force. On December 1, 1987, the New York Times, in an editorial urging the administration not to betray Haitian Democrats by shrugging off impoverished and anarchic Haiti as a hopeless case, states that doing so would undermine Washington's protestations about the need for free elections in Nicaragua. The wording is murky, and the remarks on Haiti characteristically ignore Washington's support of the Duvalierists, who made the elections a mockery. But it is clear that the Times accepts the Reagan line that free elections were not held in Nicaragua in 1984, and that the U.S. goal is to bring about free elections. This line is based on major falsifications, but in keeping with their propaganda function, the Times, as well as the other major media, find Big Brother's portrayal of elections in Central America to be true, by hook or by crook. As we stressed earlier, the media's adherence to the state propaganda line is extremely functional. Just as the government of Guatemala could kill scores of thousands without major repercussion because the media recognized that these were unworthy victims, so today aid to state terrorists in El Salvador and Guatemala and the funding of Contra attacks on soft targets in Nicaragua depend heavily on continued media recognition of worth and an appropriate legitimization and delegitimization. As their government sponsors terror in all three states, as well as in Honduras, we may fairly say that the U.S. mass media, despite their righteous self-image as opponents of something called terrorism, serve in fact as loyal agents of terrorism. Chapter 4. The KGB Bulgarian Plot to Kill the Pope. Free market disinformation as news. In the case of the Salvadoran, Guatemalan, and Nicaraguan elections, the government was the moving force in providing the suitable frames of analysis and relevant facts, with the mass media's role mainly that of channeling information and assuring that the government's agenda was not seriously challenged. With the shooting of the Pope in May 1981 and the eventual charges of a KGB Bulgarian plot, the mass media played a much larger role in originating the claims and in keeping the pot boiling from inception to conclusion of the case. In many ways, however, the process was similar. A dominant frame was eventually produced that interpreted the shooting of the Pope in a manner especially helpful to then-current elite demands. A campaign quickly ensued in which the serviceable propaganda line was instilled in the public mind by repetition. Alternative frames were ignored, and sources inclined toward other ways of looking at the issue were excluded from the mass media. Facts were selected that fit the dominant frame. Others were passed by even if they bore on the validity of its premises. At the same time, the dominant sources, who had been allowed to monopolize mass media space, complained bitterly that their voices could not be heard over the din of Soviet propaganda. When the legal proceeding brought against the Bulgarians in Italy was lost after a lengthy trial, this was rationalized by the media as far as could be done. No serious retrospectives were entertained, and without resolving the contradictions, the story was then dropped. What makes the Bulgarian connection so apt an illustration of the value of a propaganda model is that there was no credible base for a Bulgarian connection from the very beginning, and long before the Rome trial, it had taken on a truly comic aspect. But the mass media played it straight to the bitter end. An analogous sequence carried out in Moscow with the West as the target, with a half-crazed criminal after 17 months in a Soviet prison and some friendly sessions with the KGB and a prosecutor implicating employees of the American embassy in a conspiracy to murder and subsequently changing his testimony on a daily basis, would have been hooted off the stage in the West without anyone even bothering to look at alleged evidence. The Bulgarian connection, however, although no less absurd, met the criterion of utility. The case began when Mehmet Ali Agha shot and seriously injured Pope John Paul II in St. Peter's Square on May 13, 1981. Agha was a Turkish rightist and assassin long associated with the Grey Wolves, an affiliate of the extreme right-wing Nationalist Action Party. Initial Western news reports pointed out that Agha was a wanted criminal who had escaped from a Turkish prison in 1979 and that his durable political affiliations had been with the fascist right. His motives in shooting the Pope were unclear. Agha's friends were violently anti-communist, so that, at first, pinning the crime on the East seemed unpromising. Two factors allowed a KGB Bulgarian plot to be developed. The first was that in his travels through Europe in the Grey Wolves underground, which carried him through 12 different countries, Agha had stayed for a period in Bulgaria. Turkish drug dealers, who had connections with the Grey Wolves, also participated in the drug trade in Bulgaria. There were, therefore, some links between Agha and Bulgarians, minimal facts that would eventually be put to good use. The second factor was Western elite needs and the closely associated flare-up of a carefully stoked anti-communist fervor in the West. At the first meeting of the Jonathan Institute in Jerusalem in July 1979, at which a large Western political and media contingent were present, including Claire Sterling, George Will, George Bush, and Robert Moss, the main theme pressed by Israeli Prime Minister Menachem Begin in his opening address and by many others at the conference was the importance and utility of pressing the terrorism issue and of tying terrorism to the Soviet Union. Claire Sterling did this in her 1981 volume, The Terror Network, which became the Bible of the Reagan administration and the international right wing, and elevated Sterling to the status of number one mass media expert on that subject. Terrorism and Soviet evil were the centerpieces of the Reagan administration's propaganda campaign that began in 1981, designed to support its planned arms increase, placement of new missiles in Europe, and interventionist policies in the Third World. Thus, the shooting of the Pope by Agha in May 1981 occurred at a time when important Western interests were looking for ways to tie the Soviet Union to international terrorism. 4.1. The Sterling-Hensa-Kalb Model. Although the initial media reaction to the shooting was that the roots of the act would seem to lie in Turkish right-wing ideology and politics, some rightists immediately seized the opportunity to locate the origins of the plot in the Soviet bloc. Only 6 days after the assassination attempt, the Italian Secret Service Organization, SISMI, or SISMI, issued a document which claimed that the attack had been announced by a Soviet official at a meeting of the Warsaw Pact powers in Bucharest, Romania, and that Agha had been trained in the Soviet Union. Subsequently, this information was shown to have been fabricated by SISMI or one of its intelligence sources, but it entered the stream of allegations about the plot in a book published in West Germany and via further citation and leaks. The Reader's Digest saw the propaganda opportunity presented by the assassination attempt quite early and hired both Paul Hensa, a longtime CIA officer and propaganda specialist, and Claire Sterling to investigate the topic. Sterling's September 1982 article in the Reader's Digest, The Plot to Kill the Pope, was the most important initiator of the Bulgarian connection, and its ideas and those of Paul Hensa formed the basis for the NBC TV program The Man Who Shot the Pope, A Study in Terrorism, narrated by Marvin Kalb, and first aired on September 21, 1982. The Sterling-Hensa-Kalb, or SHK model, in which Agha was an agent of the Bulgarians and indirectly of the Soviet Union, quickly became the dominant frame of the mass media through the great outreach of the Reader's Digest and the NBC TV program, which was repeated in revised form in January 1983, and the ready, even eager acceptance of this view by the other mainstream media. The mass media in our sample, Newsweek, Time, The New York Times, and CBS News, all accepted and used the SHK model from the beginning and retained that loyalty to the end of the Rome trial in March 1986. In the process, they excluded alternative views and a great deal of inconvenient fact. With the Reader's Digest, the Wall Street Journal, the Christian Science Monitor, and NBC TV also firmly adhering to the SHK line, it quickly established a dominant position throughout the mainstream media. In the balance of this and the following two sections, we will describe the SHK model, discuss its weaknesses, and outline an alternative frame explaining Aja's confession implicating the Bulgarians, which the media ignored. We will then turn to a closer examination of the media's gullible reception of the SHK view and its fit to a propaganda model. The SHK model had the following essential elements. 1. Motive. In Sterling's Reader's Digest article, the preeminent motive in the assassination attempt was a Soviet desire to weaken NATO, to be accomplished by implicating a Turk in the assassination of the Pope. The Turk was there at St. Peter's to signal Christendom that Islamic Turkey was an alien and vaguely sinister country that did not belong in NATO. This motive was accompanied and soon supplanted by the contention that the shooting was to help quell the Solidarity movement in Poland by removing its most important supporter. At one point, Paul Henze suggested that the intent of the KGB was perhaps merely to wing the Pope, not kill him, as a warning, as in a James Bond movie. The costs and risks to the Soviet bloc of such a venture were never discussed by Sterling, Henze, or Kalb. 2. The proof of Soviet and Bulgarian involvement. Before Aja's confession and his identification of Bulgarians in November 1982, the evidence on which SHK relied was confined to the fact that Aja had stayed in Bulgaria in the summer of 1980, and that Turkish drug traders with links to the Grey Wolves did business in Bulgaria. In November 1982, Aja named three Bulgarians as his alleged accomplices and claimed to have been hired by the Bulgarians to do the job. He offered no credible evidence and named no witnesses to any dealings with Bulgarians, so that the new evidence was simply Aja's assertions after 17 months in an Italian prison. 3. The ideological assumptions. As the case looked extremely thin, especially before Aja's new confession of November 1982, the gaps were filled by ideological assumptions. This is the kind of thing the Soviets do. The Soviet Union and Bulgaria have been actively striving to destabilize Turkey. If there is no hard evidence, it is because the Soviets are consummate professionals who cover their tracks and maintain plausible deniability. The KGB hired Aja in Turkey and caused him to use a rightist cover to obscure the fact that he was a KGB agent. Although Aja traveled through 11 other countries, his stay in Bulgaria was crucial because Bulgaria is a totalitarian state and the police know everything. Therefore, they knew who Aja was and they must have been using him for their own purposes. 4.2. Problems with the Sterling-Henze-Kalb model. The basic Sterling-Henze-Kalb model suffered from a complete absence of credible evidence, a reliance on ideological premises, and internal inconsistencies. As problems arose, the grounds were shifted, sometimes with a complete reversal of argument. An initial problem for the model was the Bulgarian-Soviet motive. In this connection, we should note the extreme foolishness of Sterling's original suggestion that the Eastern Bloc went to the trouble of locating a Turkish fascist to shoot the Pope in order to make Turkey look bad, and thereby to loosen its ties to NATO. That such a loosened tie would follow from a Turkish fascist shooting the Pope is not sensible, nor is it likely that the conservative Soviet leadership would indulge in such a fanciful plan, even if it had a greater probability of success. This theory assumed that Aja would be caught and identified as a Turk, but that he wouldn't reveal that he had been hired by the Bulgarians and the Soviets. Subsequently, Sterling suggested that Aja was supposed to have been shot in the square to assure his silence. The amazingly incompetent KGB failed to accomplish this simple task. SHK also maintained at various points that Aja may not even have known who hired him, so he couldn't implicate the East. Later, when Aja claimed that he had been heavily involved with Bulgarians in Rome, Sterling and Henze lapsed into silence on the failure of the KGB to maintain a semblance of plausible deniability. SHK finally settled firmly on the idea that quelling the Polish Solidarity movement was the real Soviet-Bulgarian motive. But this theory is as implausible as its predecessor when we take account of timing and elementary cost-benefit analysis. Aja was allegedly recruited in Turkey long before Solidarity existed. In a variant Sterling version of the timing of his recruitment, Aja was hired by the Bulgarians in July 1980, which was still prior to the Gdansk shipyard strike, and thus before Solidarity appeared a credible threat to Soviet control. The risks and costs of an assassination attempt would seem heavy, and in fact, the costs to the Soviet Union and Bulgaria were severe based merely on the widespread belief in their involvement, even in the absence of credible evidence. The supposed benefits from the act are also not plausible. The assassination of the Pope, especially if blamed on the Soviet Union, would infuriate and unify the Poles and strengthen their opposition to a Soviet-dominated regime. And the further costs and damaged relations with Western Europe, which were extremely important to the Soviet Union in 1981, with the gas pipeline being negotiated and with the placement of new U.S. missiles in Western Europe a major Soviet concern, would seem to militate against taking foolish risks. A second problem with the SHK model is that Aja had threatened to kill the Pope in 1979 at the time of a papal visit to Turkey, again, long before Solidarity existed. This suggests that Aja and the Turkish right had their own grievances against the Pope, and a rationale for assassinating him that was independent of any Soviet influence. It was partly for this reason that SHK argued that Aja was recruited by the Soviet Union in Turkey before the Pope's visit there, setting him up for the later attack. But not only is this pure speculation unsupported by a trace of evidence, it fails to explain why the entire fascist press, not just Aja, assailed the Pope's visit in 1979. Was the entire fascist right serving Soviet ends? The only time this issue was ever raised in the mass media, on the McNeil-Lehrer NewsHour of January 5, 1983, Paul Henze stated in no uncertain terms that there was no press opposition to the Pope's visit in 1979. The Turkish journalist Uğur Mumcu, however, assembled a large collection of citations from the Turkish rightist press of the time to demonstrate that Henze's statement was false. The third problem for the SHK model was that Aja was a committed rightist and therefore not a likely candidate for service to the communist powers, although perhaps amenable to fingering them as co-conspirators in a prison context. SHK strove mightily to make Aja out to be a rootless mercenary. But the best they could come up with was the fact that Aja didn't seem to have been registered as a member of the Grey Wolves. But all his friends, associates, and affiliations from high school days onward were Grey Wolves, and in his travels through Europe up to the time of his May 13, 1981 rendezvous, he moved solely through the Grey Wolves network. While in prison, Aja addressed a letter to Alparslan Türkeş, the leader of the Nationalist Action Party of Turkey, expressing his continued commitment and loyalty. This letter was bothersome to Sterling and Henze, as it is inconsistent with their depiction of Aja as apolitical, and Sterling dismissed it without argument as a laughably clumsy forgery. A problem, however, is that Aja's letter was introduced as evidence in a trial in Ankara by the Turkish military authorities, usually adequate proof for Sterling of authenticity. She doesn't mention this fact or examine their case. Uğur Mumcu devotes 5 pages of his book Aja Dossier to a detailed account of the Türkeş letter, describing the great pains the authorities took, including tapping outside experts, to establish its authenticity. The conclusion on all sides was that the letter was genuine. A fourth problem with the SHK model is the notion that because of the efficiency of the Bulgarian secret police, Aja's presence in Sofia must have been known to them, and he must therefore have been on their payroll. This assumed efficiency is an ideological assumption unsupported by any evidence and contradicted by actual Bulgarian and Soviet performance. There is no evidence that the Bulgarians ever identified Aja, who was using a false passport. Furthermore, the contention that the Bulgarian police know everything was refuted in important testimony during the Rome trial on September 22, 1985, when Grey Wolves official Abdullah Çatla stated that many Grey Wolves preferred to traverse Bulgaria because it was easy to hide in the large flow of Turkish immigrant traffic through that country. A fifth problem for the SHK model was the fact that Aja seems to have gotten his gun through the Grey Wolves network, not from the Bulgarians, who presumably could have slipped it to him quite easily in Rome. In her Reader's Digest article, Sterling traced Aja's gun to Horst Grillmeier, an Austrian gun dealer who, according to Sterling, had fled behind the Iron Curtain after May 13, 1981, to avoid questioning in the West. It turned out later, however, that Grillmeier was a former Nazi who specialized in supplying right-wing gun buyers, that he had not disappeared behind the Iron Curtain at all, and that the gun had proceeded through a number of intermediaries to be transmitted to Aja by a Grey Wolves friend. Sterling handles the disintegration of the original Grillmeier line by simply shifting to a new conspiratorial ground. The clever Bulgarians had Aja purchase a gun through a known fascist to strengthen the case that Aja was a right-winger who could not possibly be connected to the communist powers. The final set of problems for the SHK model lies in the extraordinary level of incompetence and gross violations of the principles of plausible deniability that it attributes to the Bulgarian and Soviet secret police, features that coexist uneasily with the super spy image invoked elsewhere in the model. At various points, SHK contended that the Soviets and Bulgarians were professionals who could afford to go after the Pope because they would never be implicated themselves. But hiring Aja, a wanted criminal and a mentally unbalanced rightist, would appear extremely foolish, as the cover would quickly be blown in the likely event that he was caught. In Sterling's initial tale, the KGB wanted him to be caught, or at least to have his body identified, to discredit Turkey. With the shift to weakening solidarity as the motive, the threat of disclosure of Bulgarian-Soviet involvement would seem very serious. Yet the Bulgarians and KGB hired Aja and then failed to kill him. Another anomaly was bringing Aja to Sofia for instructions. If he had already been recruited in Turkey, wouldn't bringing him to Sofia be a foolish compromising of his carefully prepared cover? If so, doesn't his visit to Sofia constitute an argument against Soviet and Bulgarian involvement? While Aja's November 1982 confession that he had Bulgarian co-conspirators made the Bulgarian connection instantly true for the Western media, it wreaked havoc with the SHK model and with the logic of plausible deniability. If, as Aja confessed, the Bulgarians connived with him in Rome, escorted him to St. Peter's Square to plan the attack, entertained him at their apartments, and participated in the attack itself, what happens to the logic of the cover? 4.3. An alternative model. An alternative explanation of the Bulgarian connection can be derived from the questions the U.S. press would surely have raised if an analogous scenario had occurred in Moscow, in which Aja, who had briefly visited the United States on his travels and has been in a Soviet prison for 17 months after having shot a high Soviet official, now confesses that three U.S. embassy members were his co-conspirators. In this case, the U.S. press would have paid close attention to the convenience of the confession to Soviet propaganda needs, to the 17-month delay in the naming of Americans, and to the obvious possibility that Aja had been encouraged or coerced into revising his story. They would have focused intently on Aja's prison conditions, his visitors there, his amenability to a deal with his captors, and any evidence in his statements or from other sources that he had been coached. The fact that Aja had visited the United States among 12 countries would not be considered strong evidence of CIA involvement, and the press might have even pointed out that a minimally competent CIA would not have brought Aja to Washington for instructions in the first place. The alternative model would take the same fact that SHK start out with, Aja's stay in Sofia, Bulgaria, but interpret it differently. That visit violates principles of plausible deniability and would be especially foolish if the KGB had already recruited Aja in Turkey. On the other hand, it provides a Western propaganda system with the necessary tie between Aja's terrorist attack in Rome and the Soviet bloc. The convenience of Aja's confession to socialist leader Croxi, to the Christian Democrats and neo-fascists in Italy, and to Reagan searching for a tie-in between international terrorism and the Soviet Union, is also crystal clear, and would immediately suggest to an objective press the possibility that this demand might have elicited an appropriate supply from the imprisoned Aja. The lag in Aja's naming of any Bulgarians 17 months after he entered an Italian prison and 7 months after he had agreed to cooperate with the investigating magistrate, Ilario Martella, is also highly suggestive. Why did it take him so long to name his co-conspirators? Sterling tried to explain this one on the ground that Aja had hopes that the Bulgarians would spring him and gave them time. His successive elaborations of claims and subsequent retractions she explained in terms of Aja's signaling to his alleged partners. This complex and speculative attempt to rationalize inconvenient facts is not necessary. A very straightforward explanation based on Aja's character and affiliations and the inducements known to have been offered to him does quite nicely. Furthermore, Sterling's explanation does not account for the fact that Aja failed to provide serious evidence late in the trial, long after it was clear that the Bulgarians had not responded to his alleged signals. Another suggestive feature of Aja's confession is that it followed the creation and wide media distribution of the SHK model. During the course of the investigation of the plot, it was revealed that the imprisoned Aja had access to newspapers, radio, and television, among other modes of personal communication with the outside world. It was also brought out in the investigation that Aja's desire for personal publicity seems unquenchable. At one point in the Italian investigation, he abruptly clammed up when the magistrates refused his demand that journalists be present as he confessed. Aja was interrogated about a possible Bulgarian connection long before his confession, and was surely aware that his interrogators would be quite pleased to have him produce one. And by the fall of 1982, one was being provided to him in the press and on the screen every day. We mentioned earlier that the Italian Secret Service Agency SISMI had actually distributed a piece of disinformation tying the Soviets to the assassination attempt within days of the attack. At the time of the shooting, SISMI was headed by General Giuseppe Santovito, a member of the extreme right-wing organization Propaganda Due, P2, and SISMI and other intelligence agencies were heavily infiltrated with P2 members. A P2 scandal broke in Italy in March 1981, and by August, Santovito had been forced to leave SISMI, but the rightist grip on this organization was by no means broken. An important feature of Italian politics in the period from 1966 through 1981 was the protection given by the intelligence services to right-wing terror under a program designated the Strategy of Tension. One aspect of this strategy was the carrying out of right-wing terrorist attacks, which were then attributed to the left, frequently with the help of forged documents and planted informers committing perjury. The point of the strategy was to polarize society, discredit the left, and set the stage for a rightist coup. Many P2 members in the armed forces and intelligence services took part in implementing this program, and many others were sympathetic to its aims. In July 1984, an Italian parliamentary commission published its final report on the P2 conspiracy. And it and its accompanying volumes of hearings pointed up the politicization of the intelligence services, their frequent use of techniques of disinformation, and their connivance with and protection of right-wing terror. In July 1985, a Bologna court issued a decision in which it named SISMI and its officers as having engaged in numerous forgeries and also in having collaborated in covering up the Bologna terrorist bombing of 1980. SISMI participated in a 5-hour interrogation of Aja in December 1981, exploring his link to international terrorism. Investigating Judge Martella acknowledges in his long investigative report that he had spoken to Aja about the possibility of a commuted sentence if he cooperated, and the Italian press quoted Aja's lawyer's report of the terms of proposed deals that had been offered to Aja. There were also a variety of reports in the European and dissident media of pressures applied to Aja while in prison. A London Sunday Times team pointed out in May 1983 that the Secret Services visited Aja and warned him that once his solitary confinement was over, the authorities could no longer guarantee his safety. According to Orson Oyman, a Turkish expert on the case, the Catholic chaplain in Aja's prison, Father Mario Santini, had frequent access to Aja and was one of those who pressed him to cooperate with the authorities. There is some possible confirmation of Santini's pressure tactics in a letter with Aja addressed to the Vatican, dated September 24, 1982, which complained bitterly of threats to his life emanating from a Vatican emissary. During the course of the Rome trial, Giovanni Pandicio, the principal Italian state witness in the trial of mafia leaders in Naples and an associate of Raphael Cutolo, a mafia leader who had been in Ascoli Piceno prison with Aja, claimed in an interview, and subsequently before the court, that Aja had been coerced, persuaded, and coached to implicate the Bulgarians by Cutolo, Santini, and others. Pandicio claimed that Cutolo himself had been coerced into working on Aja by threats to himself, and that former SISMI officials Giuseppe Musumeci and Francesco Pacienza were key initiators of the plot. One of the important individuals accused by Pandicio, Francesco Pacienza, while denying the charges, gave his own detailed account of who in SISMI had participated in persuading Aja to talk. From the inception of the case, there were points suggesting that Aja was coached while in prison. After his long and unexplained silence, Aja identified the Bulgarians in a photo album allegedly shown to him for the first time on November 9, 1982. But in a speech before the Italian parliament, the Minister of Defense, Lelio Ligorio, stated that Aja had identified the Bulgarians in September of 1982. This discrepancy has never been explained, but that Aja saw these photos for the first time on November 9th is not believable. A key element in Aja's testimony was his claim to have visited the apartment of Sergei Antonov, one of the Bulgarians arrested in the plot, and to have met his wife and daughter, which was supported by many fine details regarding Antonov's hobbies and the characteristics of his apartment. The defense, however, was able to show that one feature of Antonov's apartment mentioned by Aja was in error, although characteristic of the other apartments in Antonov's building, which suggests that Aja had been supplied information based on observation of other apartments. More important, the defense was able to establish that at the time of Aja's visit at which he met Mrs. Antonov, she was out of the country. Following newspaper publicity given these defense contentions, on June 28, 1983, Aja retracted his claims that he had visited the apartment and met Antonov's family. The details he had given about apartment and family then became inexplicable, except on the supposition that Aja had been fed information while in prison. In a number of other instances, Aja provided information that bore strong suspicion of having been provided by officials and agents of the court or the police. The London Sunday Times reporters who interviewed one of the accused Bulgarians in Sofia wrote that when asked by Martela in Bulgaria whether he had any salient physical features, Vasiliev said that he had a mole on his left cheek. In a subsequent confession, as Vasiliev points out, Aja described my mole in the very same words which I used in describing it here. During the course of the Rome trial in 1985-86, no trace was ever found of the money that Aja claimed he had received from the Bulgarians. The car that Aja indicated the Bulgarians had used to escort him around Rome was never located. No witness was ever found who saw him in his many supposed encounters with Bulgarians. His gun was transferred to him through the Turkish Grey Wolves network, and there was no shortage of evidence of his meetings with members of the Grey Wolves in Western Europe. The note that was found on Aja's person on May 13, 1981, did not mention any collaborators and suggested a loose timetable for the assassination attempt and a planned railroad trip to Naples. In sum, it is highly probable that Aja was offered a deal to talk, and that it was made clear to him that the people with power over his well-being wanted him to implicate the Bulgarians and the Soviet Union in the assassination attempt. He had access to the SHK model even before he confessed. His confession was therefore suspect from the start, and an alternative model of inducement pressure coaching was plausible and relevant from the Aja's first implication of Bulgarians. This model became more cogent over time as Aja retracted strategic claims and as no confirming evidence of a Bulgarian connection was produced. By the same token, the SHK model, implausible from the beginning, became even less tenable. 4.4. The mass media's uncritical acceptance of the Bulgarian connection. Despite the implausibility of the SHK claim that Aja had been hired by the Bulgarians and the KGB to shoot the Pope, and although it was sustained by argument that amounted to sheer humbuggery, the Bulgarian connection met the standard of utility. In this case, therefore, as a propaganda model would anticipate, the U.S. mass media accepted the SHK model as valid, ignored the alternative model, and participated in a classic propaganda campaign that got the message of Bulgarian Soviet guilt over to the public. Some members of the mass media helped originate the claim of a Bulgarian connection, while others participated only in disseminating the SHK line and excluding alternative views and inconvenient information. The campaign began with Sterling's Reader's Digest article of September 1982, which was closely followed by the NBC TV program of September 21, 1982. The outreach of these two statements asserting a Bulgarian connection was great, and they were widely reported upon in the rest of the media in the form of a summary of their claims, with virtually no questions raised about their validity. With Aja's November 1982 naming of Bulgarians, the mass media began to report the Bulgarian connection intensively. This reporting was carried out exclusively within the frame of the SHK model, and for most of the mass media, no serious departures from this model occurred through the conclusion of the Rome trial in March 1986. Aja's naming of the Bulgarians was the key fact that generated news coverage, providing the basis for reiterated details about the Bulgarians, explanations of the Bulgarian and Soviet motive, and speculation about the political implications of the charges, if confirmed. A major characteristic of these news reports was their sheer superficiality, with the charges never seriously examined but merely regurgitated and elaborated with odd facts and opinion, and with no departures from the SHK frame, and no hints of the possible relevance of an alternative frame. The charges constituted a form of vindication of the SHK model if taken at face value and presented superficially, meaning, if the media presentations never considered political convenience, prison conditions, possible deals, plausible deniability, etc. And this procedure, a reiteration of Aja claims, supplemented by extremely superficial pro-plot speculations, was the principal modality by which the mass media accepted and pushed the propaganda line. Newsweek provides a prototype of news coverage within the SHK framework in its article of January 3, 1983, The Plot to Kill Pope John Paul II. The Bulgarian Soviet motive, as portrayed by SHK, is reiterated through quotes from congenial sources, a precautionary and alternative solution to the invasion of Poland, while nobody is quoted discussing costs and benefits, the nature of the Soviet leadership, or Western benefits from Aja's confession. In fact, Newsweek suggests that this charging of the Soviet bloc with the assassination attempt is a painful embarrassment to Western governments, parroting the SHK line on this point. Newsweek nowhere discusses the 17-month lag in Aja's confession or his prison conditions, nor does it report in this or any other article the claims and information noted by the London Sunday Times and the Italian press about inducements or coercive threats that might have been applied to Aja while in custody. Aja's evidence is given credibility by Newsweek through several devices, repeating his claims several times as the core of the story, stressing in two separate sequences investigative Judge Martella's alleged honesty, integrity, conscientiousness, etc., quoting from Italian officials who say they have the evidence that Aja operated in close contact with the Bulgarians, asserting that all the evidence suggests that Aja is not crazy. But most important is the previously mentioned refusal to discuss the premises of the SHK framework or to use an alternative frame. Newsweek swallows intact a series of SHK ideological assumptions, such as that investigators, read Paul Henze, now think Aja was probably using the Grey Wolves as a cover. Bulgaria and the Soviet Union have long been trying to destabilize Turkey through terrorism, quoting Henze directly. In Sofia, Aja's presence must have come to the attention of the Bulgarian secret police, duplicating the frequent SHK error of forgetting their claim that Aja had already been recruited for the papal assassination attempt in Turkey, as well as erroneously assuming that the Bulgarian secret police can easily identify Turks passing through their country. Newsweek states as established fact that Adja had help from a huge set of Bulgarians, although it provides no evidence for this except assertions by Adja, Italian officials, and Paul Henze. It reports Adja's numerous transactions with Bulgarians in Rome without mentioning the problem of plausible deniability and without batting an eyelash at the sheer foolishness of the scenario. This Newsweek article is nonetheless powerful, with its reiteration of many details, its confidently asserted plots and subplots, its quotes from many authorities supporting the charges, and its seeming openness and occasional mention of lack of full proof. But it is a piece of uncritical propaganda that confines itself strictly within the SHK frame, with the exception of the single phrase cited earlier. Initially, the other major media performed quite uniformly in the same mold, uncritical, trivial, working solely within the bounds of the SHK model, and entirely bypassing all the hard but obvious questions raised by the alternative model. Of the 32 news articles on or closely related to the plot that appeared in the New York Times between November 1, 1982 and January 31, 1983, 12 had no news content whatever, but were reports of somebody's opinion or speculation about the case, or refusal to speculate about the issue. The Times carried one news article whose sole content was that President Reagan had no comment on the case. More typical was the front-page article by Henry Kamm, Bonn is fearful of Bulgaria tie with terrorists, December 12, 1982, or Bernard Gwertzman's U.S. intrigued but uncertain on a Bulgarian tie, December 26, 1982. In news report after news report, unnamed individuals are intrigued, their interest is piqued, evidence is said to be not wholly convincing, or final proof is still lacking. Four of the news articles in the Times were on peripheral subjects such as smuggling in Bulgaria or papal-Soviet relations. On the 16 more direct news items, only one covered a solid news fact, namely Antonov's arrest in Rome. The other 15 news items were trivia, such as Kamm's Bulgarians Regret Tarnished Image, January 27, 1983, or another Kamm piece entitled Italian Judge Inspects Apartment of Suspect in Bulgarian Case, January 12, 1983. All of these expressions of opinion, doubts, interest, suppositions, and minor detail served to produce a lot of smoke, which kept the issue of possible Soviet involvement before the public. They steered quite clear of substantive issues that bore on motives, quality of evidence, and Turkish and Italian context. During the years that followed, to the end of the trial in March 1986, the mass media, with only minor exceptions, adhered closely and uncritically to the SHK framework. They not only failed to press alternative questions, they also refused to examine closely the premises, logic, or evidence supporting the SHK case. Part of the reason for this was the media's extraordinary reliance on Sterling and Henze as sources, and Kalb's position as a news reporter on NBC TV, and their unwillingness to ask these sources probing questions. 4.5. Biased Sourcing. Sterling and Henze, and to a lesser extent Michael Ledeen, dominated perceptions of the Bulgarian connection in the U.S. mass media to a remarkable degree. Moreover, they affected the course of events in Italy, as their version of Bulgarian guilt was aired in the Italian media before Adja named the Bulgarians and may have influenced Martella as well. Sterling and Henze dominated media coverage by virtue of the very wide distribution of their articles and books on the case, and by their extensive and uncritical use as experts by the elite press, news magazines, and television news and talk shows. Sterling, in addition to her Reader's Digest article, had three substantial pieces in the Wall Street Journal and several articles in the New York Times. Her views were given repeated airing on CBS News without rebuttal. Henze accounted for 12 of the 14 articles on the Bulgarian connection case in the Christian Science Monitor between September 1982 and May 1985, and his articles were used widely elsewhere. The only opinion piece on the Bulgarian connection that appeared in the Philadelphia Inquirer during that same period was by Michael Ledeen. Sterling, Henze, and Ledeen together accounted for 76% of the time in three shows on the subject on the McNeil-Lehrer NewsHour. No tough questions were asked of them on these shows, and no dissident voices were heard, perhaps because Sterling and Hensa refused to appear on television shows or in college debates with people who opposed their views, and Hensa insisted on approving in advance any questions to be asked. Thus, their initial dominance was further enhanced by coercive tactics. If we ask the deeper question of why these experts should predominate in the first place, we believe the answer must be found in the power of their sponsors and the congeniality of their views to the corporate community and the mainstream media. Their messages passed quite easily through the filters of a propaganda system. Sterling was funded and published by Reader's Digest, which gave her enormous outreach and immediate brand name recognition. The conservative network is fond of Sterling, so their large stable of columnists and think tank affiliates, like the Georgetown Center for Strategic and International Studies, CSIS, and the American Enterprise Institute, pushes her views. The Reagan administration was also delighted with Sterling, despite her frequent denunciations of the CIA and the State Department for their cowardice in failing to pursue terrorism and the Bulgarian connection with sufficient aggressiveness, and so were the New York Times, Time, Newsweek, CBS News, and many others. Sterling was the outstanding popular expositor of the theme urged upon the conferees at the Jonathan Institute meeting of July 1979 and advocated by the Reagan administration team anxious to create a moral environment for an arms race and global support of counter-revolutionary freedom fighters. Hensa, an old CIA hand and protege of Zbigniew Brzezinski, was also funded by the Reader's Digest, and Ledeen was affiliated with both the CSIS and the Reagan political team. If the media transmit literal lies by this big three, which they did frequently, the flak machines remain silent. As one network official told one of the authors, if a critic of the Bulgarian connection were allowed on the air, the official would have to make sure that every I was dotted and T was crossed, but with Sterling, there were no problems. Again, in conformity with the propaganda model, it was of no apparent concern to the mass media that Sterling, Hensa, and Ledeen were exceptionally biased sources, immune to the rules of evidence and, in fact, agents of disinformation. We discussed earlier Sterling's dismissal of Aja's commitment to Turkesh and her handling of Aja's gun, and similar cases could be cited in large number. Sterling's terror network is notable for its gullibility in accepting at face value claims fed her by Israel, South African, and Argentinian secret police, and most notably, the Czech Stalinist defector Jan Sejna, whose evidence for a Soviet terror network came from a document forged by the CIA to test Sejna's integrity. A remarkable feature of Sterling's Time of the Assassins and other writings on the Bulgarian connection is her reiterated belief that the Reagan administration and CIA dragged their feet in pursuing the Red Plot because of their interest in détente. And despite her phenomenal sales and uncritical reception in the U.S. media, Sterling bemoaned the accepted position, the socially indispensable position if you care to move in certain circles and if you care to be accepted at your job professionally in the West, of doubting the Bulgarian connection, which she attributed to the success of the KGB in pushing a 40-page booklet on the plot by Soviet journalist Iona Andronov. These evidences of charlatanry did not impair Sterling's credibility with the U.S. mass media. In fact, the New York Times allowed her front-page space and a regular role as a reporter of news on the Bulgarian connection. By doing this, the Times guaranteed that editorial policy would control the news fit to print. This was displayed fully in Sterling's front-page news story of Prosecutor Albano's report on June 10, 1984. The most important new information in that report, that on June 28, 1983, Aja had retracted a substantial part of his evidence against the Bulgarians, was omitted from Sterling's story, although she coyly suggested that some undescribed points had been retracted that were already corroborated. This was seriously misleading. Aja's having visited Antonov's apartment and met with his family was never corroborated, and the details he gave on these matters had previously been cited by Sterling and Hensa as crucial corroboration of his general claims. His retraction thus led to the important question of how Aja had learned details about Antonov's apartment without having been there. This issue was never seriously addressed in the New York Times. Paul Henze was a longtime CIA official who had been head of the CIA station in Turkey and a specialist in propaganda. Former Turkish head of state Bülent Ecevit even accused Henze of helping destabilize Turkey during his term of operations there. Henze never refers in his news articles to his active participation in Turkish affairs as a CIA official. His writings are notable for their consistent apologetics for military rule in Turkey, for their dishonesty, and for the fact that Henze openly disdains the use of rules of evidence in proving Soviet villainy. Michael Ledeen, as we saw in Chapter 1, contends that the mass media believe Gaddafi more readily than the U.S. government, and focus more heavily on the victims of state terror of U.S. client states, Indonesia in East Timor and Guatemala, than in enemy and radical states, Cambodia and Poland. Again, such absurdities do not reduce Ledeen's access to the mass media as an expert on the Bulgarian connection or on anything else. The mass media not only allowed these disinformation sources to prevail, they protected them against disclosures that would reveal their dubious credentials. That Henze was a longtime CIA official was almost never mentioned in the press, never to our knowledge on television, and his consistent apologetics for the Turkish military regime and frequent lies were never disclosed. In Sterling's case, her numerous errors of fact, foolish arguments, and wilder political opinions were not disclosed to readers of the New York Times, Time, or Newsweek, or watchers of CBS News or the McNeil-Lehrer NewsHour, and even newsworthy matters bearing on her qualifications were ignored. For example, Sterling's numerous attacks on the murdered French activist radical Henri Curiel resulted in suits for slander brought against her in Paris. The New York Times has never mentioned these slander suits, which would put Sterling in a bad light, not only because she lost them in whole or part, but also because of the insight they provide concerning her sources and methods. Sterling had gotten much of her information from a French journalist, Georges Souffert, who was a conduit for French and South African intelligence, and who had obligingly placed the African National Congress at the top of his list of terrorist organizations. In her Terror Network, Sterling strongly intimates that Curiel was a KGB agent, but the French court, on the basis of documents provided by French intelligence, found no support for this claim. Sterling retreated to the defense that her insinuation of Curiel's KGB connection was merely a hypothesis rather than an assertion of fact. The case, in short, showed that she was a conduit of disinformation, quite prepared to slander a murdered radical on the basis of claims by extreme right-wing disinformation sources. Michael Ledeen, a neoconservative activist and disinformationist with ready access to the Times, has also received its close protection. His book, Grave New World, was reviewed in the Times by William Griffith, a Reader's Digest roving editor and right-wing MIT political scientist who found Ledeen's version of the Bulgarian connection entirely convincing. Ledeen was deeply involved with Francesco Pazienza in the Billygate affair and had numerous contacts with Italian intelligence and the Italian extreme right. The Italian fascist and head of P2, Licio Gelli, hiding in Uruguay, instructed one of his accomplices to convey a manuscript to Ledeen. Pazienza claimed, and Seize Me head Santovito confirmed, that Ledeen was a member of the Italian intelligence agency Seize Me with code number Z3. Ledeen received over $100,000 from Seize Me for services rendered, including the supplying of stale U.S. intelligence reports that Seize Me then passed off as its own. Ledeen funneled this money into a Bermuda bank account. His manipulative activities in Italy were on such a scale that in the summer of 1984, a newly appointed head of Seize Me told the Italian parliament that Ledeen was a meddler and persona non grata in Italy. None of these points was ever disclosed in the Times. 4.6. The Propaganda Agenda. Questions unasked, sources untapped. There is a close linkage among sources used, frames of reference, and agendas of the newsworthy. When the mass media chose to use Sterling, Henze, and Ledeen heavily, they simultaneously adopted a frame of reference in which the Bulgarians and Soviets were presumed guilty. Aja was an apolitical mercenary, and justice was being promoted by diligent Judge Martella in free world Italy. In the propaganda campaign that ensued, hard questions about the quality of the SHK model were simply not asked, and alternative sources and frames were ignored. A distinction between matters on and off the agenda, such as we used in the previous chapter, is once again applicable and illuminating. On the agenda are statements by Aja and Martela about Aja's latest claims and proofs of Bulgarian involvement, Brzezinski's opinion on whether the Bulgarians are likely to have engaged in such an escapade, they were, or Judy Woodruff's question to Paul Henze as to whether the Soviets would have any notion, any desire to try this again. They do this kind of thing all the time, just got a little careless here because they had got away with so much in Italy. As in the Third World election cases described in Chapter 3, the media prefer to focus on superficial detail about the participants and opinions within a narrow range of establishment views, plus bluff denials by Bulgarian and Soviet officials. Along with each development supporting the accepted case, a defector's accusations, a further Aja confession, an investigator's or prosecutor's report, and leaks of alleged claims or expected new developments, whatever its credibility. Off the agenda are arguments and facts that would call into question the validity of the basic SHK model and those relating to the alternative model, which starts with the question of why Aja confessed so late and the likelihood that he was encouraged and pressed to talk. We will run through only a few of the important questions and points of evidence that the mass media put off the agenda. The basic SHK model rested its case on the Soviet motive, Aja's stay in Sofia, and the high professionalism of the Soviet and Bulgarian secret police, which made it likely that they were manipulating Aja if he stopped off in Bulgaria. Only the ABC 2020 program of May 12, 1983, explored the Soviet motive in any depth, despite the constant mass media reiteration of the SHK line. ABC went to the trouble of asking the Vatican about the validity of Marvin Kalb's claim that the Pope had written a note threatening to resign and to return to Poland to lead the resistance to any Soviet invasion. Cardinal John Krall, speaking for the Vatican, said that not only was there not such a letter, but such a letter directly from the Pope to Brezhnev would have been a total departure from all normal procedures. In no way could you conceive of the Holy Father saying, "I would resign." ABC's information from the Vatican, too, was that the Pope's spoken message to Brezhnev was conciliatory. This spectacular repudiation of an important element in the SHK case was unreported in the rest of the media and simply died with the ABC broadcast. And any balancing of supposed gains against the costs and risk to the Soviet Union in sponsoring Aja was simply not undertaken in the mass media. None of them stopped to evaluate Aja's 1979 letter threatening to kill the Pope on his earlier visit to Turkey. Sterling's ludicrous claim that the KGB hired a Turk to kill the Pope in order to damage Turkey's relation to NATO was never discussed. The question of the authenticity of Aja's letter to Türkeş, which bears on Aja's political commitments and thus another SHK premise, was never discussed in the U.S. mass media. During the trial, Abdullah Çatlı's statement that Bulgaria was a preferred gray wolf route to Europe because of the relative ease of hiding in the heavy Turkish traffic, which directly contradicts the SHK claim that the Bulgarian secret police know everything and that Aja's stay in Sofia must therefore have been by Bulgarian official plan, was never picked up in the U.S. mass media's coverage of the Rome trial. The most striking deficiencies of the mass media's handling of the basic SHK claims, however, was their remarkable naivete in the face of the pseudoscientific speculations of SHK and the accumulating violations of elementary principles of plausible deniability. The preposterous SHK claims, without a vestige of evidence, that Aja had been recruited by the KGB in Turkey for future work, and that he took on the appearance of a right-winger as a cover, were not ridiculed and were not evaluated when presented as purported truth. There was never any discussion in the mass media of the fact that the thesis of prior recruitment and careful cultivation of Aja's cover in Turkey was flatly inconsistent with the claim that he was brought to Sofia for a lengthy stay for instructions. With regard to Aja's alleged open dealings with Bulgarians in Rome, The mass media simply refused to discuss the fact that the alleged professionalism and use of the right-wing Turk as a cover had disappeared. As regards the alternative model and the likelihood that Aja had been encouraged and coached, here also the mass media refused to explore these dissonant possibilities. They simply would not examine and discuss the convenience of the newly discovered plot for so many Western interests, the huge time lag in the naming of Bulgarians, Aja's prison conditions and prison contacts, reports of meetings, offers, and threats to Aja to induce him to talk, and the compromised character of the Italian police and intelligence agencies. This involved the media in the suppression of important documents. As one important instance, the July 12, 1984 Italian report of the Parliamentary Commission on the Masonic Lodge P2 describes in great detail the penetration of this massive neo-fascist conspiracy into the military establishment, secret services, press, and judiciary, among others. This report was newsworthy in its own right, but it also had a bearing on the Bulgarian connection case, as it addressed characteristics of Italian institutions that were directly involved in making and prosecuting the case against the Bulgarians. The New York Times, Time, Newsweek, and CBS Evening News never mentioned the publication of this report. As a second major illustration, one year later, in July 1985, the Criminal Court of Rome handed down a judgment in the matter of Francesco Pazienza et al.